Hello everyone. Welcome, good evening. Hope you're all well. Happy New Year to you all. Still got a few more people logging in. Hopefully Debbie's joining us shortly. She said she couldn't find the email. So don't know what happened there. But anyway, we'll trust that she'll find a way to log in somehow. So welcome to 2012. And I was talking with someone just a week or two ago who I'd not met before, and she was asking me about my work. And immediately started to bombard me with questions because she could see that this might be something that could be helpful to her. She felt like she was been in a stuck place for a long time. And I was answering the questions as patiently as I could. And after maybe 5 minutes or so, I could see that her mind was starting to slow down enough to actually take in what was being said. Whereas initially, I could see that wasn't happening. You know that experience sometimes where it's almost as if anything that you might say to someone, it bounces off them because there's too much in there already. There's just not enough room for something to go in, something new to go in. So that was how it looked initially. And then there was this kind of settling down, and she stopped asking questions quite so rapidly, started listening a bit more closely, and had some glimpses of what it was that I was trying to explain to her. And I could see, just you can tell from the expression on somebody's face, and also there's a kind of shift of energy when somebody starts to open to something that they hadn't been open to before. And I could see that happening. And then what was funny was suddenly she jumped up from the chair she was sitting. Stop, she said, stop, stop, wait, don't say another word. She went out of the room and came back with her BlackBerry. And she said, just wait a minute, because I need to write this down. She said, whatever it is that you're saying, I need to write it down, because I know that as soon as I go out of here, I'll forget it. And I suggested to her that she might want to consider the possibility that, first of all, that was okay, that she didn't necessarily need to remember the words, that she would perhaps remember in another way, that, you know, that when we really see something for ourselves that's new, we don't have to think to remember that. When we suddenly realize something on the inside, then it's not something we have to remind ourselves. We only have to do that when we haven't really seen it yet. Anyway, she wasn't particularly open to that suggestion, so she frantically started typing on a tiny keypad on her BlackBerry. And it was interesting to me because I could see that was obviously something that was probably a habit that she had, or whenever she came across something that she thought was important to remember, she had to type it into the BlackBerry so that she could review it later on. And it was just such a striking example to me of how a certain kind of thinking can take us away from the present. And it's one of many strategies that we all use to let's say, to escape the present moment or to avoid the present moment. So I thought I'd just start off by sharing that and just suggesting that that's something to notice if any of you have that tendency to start worrying about getting it down or remembering it or, you know, making sure that it's going to be recorded. And these kind of anxieties are coming from a kind of thinking that is future oriented. It says that in sometime in the future I'm going to need to be able to recollect this or to remind myself. And there's a kind of implied lack of trust in that, let's say, that deeper wisdom inside of us, which actually doesn't need reminding at all. It already knows what this is about and it recognizes it immediately. So the invitation is it's basically not to try too hard or, to effort to either remember or understand or to get anything down. And to see the value in actually just relaxing and trusting and just being open to the possibility that even if it's just a fragment, that the fragment that actually goes in and touches the right spot, that's the bit that was needed. And I often think of this as it's like the homeopathic principle in action. We don't need much in the way of insight in order to give us a whole different orientation on life. It's not as if we have to remember every quote, every detail, every phrase and piece of terminology. Not at all. Essentially, it's a very small thing that has subsequently large ripple that it sends out. So I wanted to start off just by sharing that because this person was just in my thoughts today. I had this amusing image of her looking at her BlackBerry a few days afterwards, just wondering what the hell any of these words meant. And probably, I'm guessing, not really managing to get much in the way of value out of it. Now, I've had a couple of nice emails from a few of you. Thanks for those of you who took the trouble to write in, sharing bits from your own experience. And I just want to say for future reference that that's fine too, that even though I put out a request for things like questions or topics, it could also be just, what's on your mind, what's been around for you, what's been present. And as a way of bringing your own focus just into the present moment, it can be helpful sometimes just to notice what is it that you've been dwelling on or aware of, literally just in the last 24 hours or even less than that. I tend to trust that whatever's uppermost at any given moment is that's the raw material, if you like, that we're ready to be conscious of in that moment, not to worry about anything else. So even if it seems something trivial, if it occurs to you when maybe when you're plugging in for the webinar or just getting the email, that reminder that I'm sending out, if there's just something that occurs to you when you see that, even if it doesn't seem directly related, I'd encourage you just to share it anyway, or just write it down, or drop me a note, or share it here in this forum, because it might be that in an indirect way that there's something there for you, which it might be only for you, but in the act of sharing it and making it conscious, it could be that we'll all benefit. And that was actually one of the themes that came out from something that was emailed in to me. It was this, again, paradoxical fact that on the one hand, it is helpful to hear other people's experience, to learn from other people's understanding of this. But its value is limited to the extent that it only helps if it resonates with something inside you and me at that moment. And there's a lot of things that we're going to hear and read and see that don't resonate, and consequently, they're lost on us in that moment. In the same way as you can read something in a certain frame of mind, let's say, or a certain place of consciousness, and not find it particularly illuminating. It might be interesting, it might not. And then you can go back to that same passage or book or whatever it is, a couple of years later, suddenly it jumps off the page. And you've read it before, and yet it touches you in a completely different way. It's fresh. It's as if you're seeing it for the first time with fresh eyes. And that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about when we relax and open. We just allow the things that are for us, that are right for us, to touch us, and don't worry about the rest. And it's a small percent that's going to be in that category. And it sometimes comes in from left field. And that to me is one of the great values of of doing a lot of work with groups is that I often find it's not anything that I might say, it's something that someone else says that was in response to something that I said, which in turn was in response to what someone else said. And you could never have laid that out. You could never have planned for a person to have any kind of realization by that sequence of events. It's just how it happened. But by being alert to that possibility that it could be a throwaway comment, it could be something that doesn't seem directly related to the topic at hand. If you are open and trusting that every moment is presenting us with opportunities to deepen in our understanding, then I think the degree to which we're open to that is the degree to which we can experience that as being real. And just another thing I wanted to add to that is what it is that starts to take place as we're exposed to this understanding in a variety of ways. And when I say exposed to it, I mean hearing it, maybe reading some of the articles and literature that's been written, watching some of the video clips that you find, being in a room or a webinar like this, where there's an environment where we're kind of connecting with a shared intention, picking things up energetically, not just through words. What's really it taking place that's of lasting value? It's not that we're trying to change how we experience life, or that we're trying to change the world around us. Most of us have already tried that and discovered that it's of limited value, to say the least. What's actually happening is that we're subtly shifting the place that we're actually seeing the world from. And even that is misleading because it implies that that's something that we do, we shift the place. It's more that that's what happens, is that we start to see the same circumstance from a different place within ourselves. Or we start to experience, let's say, a relationship in a new way. It's the same relationship, it's with the same person, and yet suddenly you feel differently about it, and you feel differently towards the other person. And this is a subtle thing, and yet it is also the most powerful thing, because it's the place that we experience life from that seems to largely determine what, let's say, what flavor of experience we have, whether it's enjoyable, easy, free-flowing, or whether it's full of struggle and difficulty, and discomfort and pain. The other aspect to that, which is again somewhat puzzling, is that the best we can hope for is that we're settling into, or let's say returning to, or settling into something that we've always been. It's not that we're, through our study or our learning or our effort, it's not that we're attaining something new. This again is misleading. We talk about levels of consciousness, this idea that we're going to move to a higher level of consciousness somehow through coming to an understanding or through our own efforts, through self-development and so on. And yet, when we start to see kind of underneath that, we understand what's actually happening, it seems that what we're really doing is just defaulting back to something which has been always ever present inside of us. And it's that same quality of being that we see in young children that we admire so much, that quality of open, free, spontaneous, in the moment, playful, present time awareness, that also has a creative aspect to it, among many other qualities. There's that recognition that it's not a new thing to be learned. It's simply relaxing into that which we always were, and which we'd simply become temporarily blinded to. Through getting caught in thinking, which takes us away from that awareness. And the next little bit of that is realizing that the act of thinking is not the problem either. So you can see the kind of sequence that the mind tends to go through, the personal mind, that is. First of all, assuming that it has to do something and that something has to be attained, and you realize, actually, no, this is what I already am. There's nothing to do here. And then there's that thought, well, I need to remember it. Well, no, because what we're talking about is who we are already. How can we forget that? It's not something that can ever be forgotten. We can be temporarily unaware, but we can't lose who we essentially are. And also then recognizing that all those qualities that we've been looking, usually outside of ourselves, to attain, or through what we think is our own efforts, looking to develop through various methods and techniques and practices, realizing that actually they're all built in. They're innate, they're inherent, and no one ever took them away. It's just that we have the ability to limit our access to things like the flow of love in our life and the flow of creativity in our life and the experience of freedom and joy and all those things that we go looking for. We can never not have them, but what we can do is limit our access to them in moment by moment. And then, as we start to see, well, how do we actually do that? What's the mechanism that seems to take us away? And it must be something really complicated. And this, to me, was the genius of Sid Banks, was to recognize it's the most ridiculously simple thing. That's why we miss it. It's not because it's complex, but because it's blindingly obvious. It's so obvious we can't see it. It's just thought. It's only when we get caught in our thought and we mistake it for reality, that we, in a way, we do the equivalent of what we do every night when we go into a dream. When we're actually experiencing the dream, it seems real. And our physiology seems to confirm how real it is. If it's a scary dream, we're having not only feelings of anxiety and fear, but we're having physiological responses that correspond: increased heart rate and respiration rate, sweating, this kind of thing. And when the physiology starts to confirm our experience, it seems to make it real for us. It has that effect of turning the illusion into something tangible and concrete. And yet, we all know that the moment we wake up from a dream, it loses all its potency that it had just a moment ago. A moment ago we were in it, somebody was chasing us, or the house was on fire, or whatever it was that was happening, some dilemma that we had to get out of through our own efforts. And then the moment we wake up, we just go, oh. All of that emotional charge that was somehow making it real, it dissipates very, very quickly. I mean, we might be left with a kind of overtone of feeling for a while, but generally speaking, the realization that it was just a dream is the antidote to all of that. It's what suddenly it loses its potency, it loses its hold on us. And in the same way, when we start to see that thought during our waking hours plays exactly the same trick on us as dreams do. It's so convincing, and it's backed up not only by feelings, but also by physiological changes, literally chemical changes in our bodies, which makes it seem so real. And not only that, we get feedback from the outside world, which obviously tends to confirm whatever we're thinking and feeling. And yet, any moment that we can remember or realize, this has all been produced by thought. And it's only the fact that I believe this thought, I take it as real in this moment, that's causing me to be upset by it or distressed in some way or powerfully affected. And the moment we see that, again, then we might be left with some feeling tone for a little while, but it depotentiates it very quickly. As soon as we realize, oh, it's not this situation that's making me feel this way, it's not that other person, it's not the fact that I don't have the money to pay my bills that's stressing me out this month. It's not the fact that the car won't start. All those things, everyday things that we might get frustrated by or anxious about, we suddenly realize it's not any of those things that are creating that experience of life. It's all been internally generated. And the leap that the mind seems to take as soon as we start to get close to grasping that is, well, okay, so thought then obviously is the problem. What do I need to do to stop my thinking? Or at least to modify it to make sure that I have only positive thoughts which result in pleasant feelings. And the next piece of the puzzle that gets revealed is, well, actually, there isn't a great deal we can do to stop thought. If thought happens, we weren't voluntarily thinking it in the first place. So what is it that leads us to think we can suddenly start voluntarily putting the brakes on it? And I like this aspect of the, for me, this was a great piece of the jigsaw which fell into place for me was realizing that acceptance of the fact that we think is really one of the key ingredients to all of this. Not fighting with that fact, not trying to do anything about it, not trying to improve, modify, amend, or stop thinking in any way. Just letting thought be what it is. Let it happen as and when it happens. And at the same time, recognizing that the act of thinking itself is no problem at all. It's no more of a problem than the act of breathing or digesting or any of the other automatic things that we do and take for granted. It's simply part of what we human beings do. Maybe some other species do it too, I don't know. But we know that this is what's given to us humans in terms of our own life experience. We're thinking, feeling beings. That's the deal. And arguing with that fact is not particularly helpful. And I know that there are, for example, meditation practices and mind trainings, for example, which have the express intention of at least trying to slow down the mind or to create gaps in the thinking. And it's not to say that these are useless or unhelpful. They might be helpful, but as a kind of stepping stone. And it's to me they would be in the category of the raft that helps you get across the river at a certain point. Sometimes it's helpful, but then there's a point where we recognize that we don't have to keep doing that. It could make for a lot of work to try to track your thoughts, to try to stop your thoughts, to try to amend or improve your thoughts. Many of us have tried that with various techniques. And what for me was so refreshing about this three principles understanding is that none of that's necessary. And interestingly, I find that that's one of the main points of resistance that I find when I'm sharing this with people, is that there's so little to do. There's so little to do that people drive themselves crazy trying to find things to do with this and discovering that none of them are relevant or helpful. On the contrary, they all have the same effect, which is to take us away from the present time awareness, just like typing into the BlackBerry to make sure that we get everything down. I think somewhere Sid Banks says, he said, "My words may seem too simple, but I tell you the truth is simple." And I'm willing to go with that. You know, that rings true to me in the same way as one of the first kind of, let's say, spiritually inclined teachings that I ever came across was actually the writings of Edward Bach, the flower essence developer. And one of the things that struck me about what he did was he spent his whole life trying to pare it down to its bare bones. You know, there was a lot more material on his essences and everything when he first started out. And he made a habit of destroying all of his notes and all of his tests and everything so that people wouldn't get caught in that. And he ended up with like this little booklet which had about 18 pages in it called The 12 Healers. And he wanted it to be so simple that anyone could pick it up and make use of it. And he wrote in there somewhere, "Let not the simplicity of this method deter you from its use." He was obviously aware of the fact that it would, that people would, you know, they'd skip through the 17 pages and say, "Oh, yeah, okay, so what? Where's the real stuff? You know, where's the stuff that I need to spend 4 years studying before I can call myself a practitioner?" And that wasn't the intention. The intention was that anyone should be able to pick it up and make use of it. And I sense that Sid Banks had the same kind of feeling for this that he understood in a very simple way is something that any of us can grasp if we're able to be to meet it at that level, if you like. And it seems that it becomes harder the more that we've already done. That's what I've noticed, is that oftentimes people who are able to accept the simplicity of this without much question or resistance are people that have had very limited exposure to anything of this kind or any kind of personal development work, should we say. Very often there's a readiness and a willingness to just take it at face value and say, "Okay, so that's how it works." Yep. And not to need to add a great deal to it. So, and I know that most of us on this course are not in that category. You know, we've come a whole journey, and it's not to devalue the experiences that we've had, that we've learned from, and the insights that we've gained along the way. But it's to recognize that not everything can be learned in the same way. You know, some things are content-based, and there's a requirement, like if you're learning a homeopathy or something like that, there is a requirement to learn a certain body of information and of knowledge, of content. And as far as I can tell, that's really not the case with this. And so to approach it in that way would be a mistake. To try and turn it into something which is a, you know, a major, a major piece of study that requires detailed analysis and comparison and understanding on an intellectual level and so on. We know that doesn't work with this. It forces us to approach it from a different place. Paradoxically, I think I've read a lot of Carl Jung's work over the years, and that's not the kind of stuff you can, most of it anyway, it's not the kind of stuff you can read lightly. It requires some kind of application to really get to grips with it, and it's hugely voluminous. I mean, I've got bookshelves, whole bookshelves, dedicated just to Jung and his contemporaries' writings, and yet, every now and again, I get the gist of what he felt to be the most important part of what he was saying. And the things that have jumped out at me is quotes like where he says, "It's what you are that heals. It's not what you know." That to me is probably the single most important thing I learned from probably 8 or 9 years of studying Jungian literature. Having acquired all this knowledge, he says, "That's not it. That's not what heals ultimately. It's not what's helpful. It's the quality of being that counts more than any knowledge." So even someone who went, who was an academic and who went through the very, very rigorous path of knowledge, in a sense came to the same place, came to the same realization. And when Jung talks about what he called the process of individuation, it still has relevance for me. Partly because what I like about that term was that it shows us that we have to respect the individual nature of realization, is that no one's going to get it in the same two ways, and that it's something that it has to come from within us in order to have any real impact on our life and to have any lasting value. And so consequently, it's always uniquely tailored for each one of us. The other thing about that which I like was that he talks about it as a shifting of the center of gravity, is the term that he used. It's a shifting of the center of gravity from the ego to the self. And by the self, what am I understanding of that? He's pointing to that bigger wisdom, which in the three principles language we would call the mind or the universal intelligence, that aspect of human nature, which is in a way impersonal. It's much bigger than the personal thinking mind. And what he saw over his own lifetime and through his own experience was that that's something that can and does happen for people. You can't make it happen, but there is a process of shedding and letting go, and what he called a disidentification with the ideas about who we think we are and what we think our role in life is supposed to be. And I know that this is relevant to some of you who've written to me about it, that's one of the, let's say, it's one of the ways of understanding what starts to take place inside of us as this filters through. It's not that we've got a new philosophy to speak about. It's simply that we're moving to a different place within ourselves. The center of gravity is moving, and for some that can be disturbing. It's not for everybody disturbing, but for some people it is. It can give rise to a temporary, let's say, loss of equilibrium. There's a feeling of being not quite sure who the hell you are for a time or what your role is anymore. It can cause all kinds of things that we felt certain about to suddenly start to seem very uncertain. It can also cause us to question our motives for doing things. We start to realize that a lot of our behaviors and habits and even maybe the role that we've played in life has been driven by certain factors which are simply no longer driving it. An example would be in the healing work, for example, where initially the impulse to get into healing work could well be the result of trying to heal our own wounds. We talk about that as, the wounded healer phenomena, and realizing suddenly that that's no longer relevant. That if you're no longer on that endless search to heal yourself through healing others, then suddenly, what is it about then? What's driving your work now? There's a requirement to find another place to work from. And yet, what seems to happen is that place naturally arises if we let it. It's not something that we have to really go looking for or to force in any way. It's often the case that what we find is that we can do exactly the same thing that we've been doing before. We could do the same work. We can be in the same relationship. Chances are we've still got the same family. You know, we can't just change that overnight. And yet, we can have a whole different way of relating to those factors in our life, which is typically much freer. It's much freer. It's free of the any kind of anxiety or neediness, insecurity, these kind of things that are often lurking in the background. You know, the fear of what would happen if I lose this role or this job and so forth. Or conversely, there can be a feeling of that it's really important that I do this, that this really matters. I think it was Bertrand Russell who said that that's one of the signs of an impending nervous breakdown, is the belief or the idea that one's work is terribly important. So he was recognizing that when we start taking ourselves too seriously, and it can be really just very freeing to realize it. You can do the same thing without that, without it being the most, you know, life-defining thing. And it brings a kind of playful quality to it, where we can actually enjoy it for what it is. And also we can put it down and let it go much easier. That's what I noticed with, for example, with my client work, as the place that I was working from started to change. I realized that I could just drop it much easier. When I was with the person, I could be really with them, but I could also let it go. The moment they walked out of the room, it was finished for me. And there was no necessity for me to keep pondering it afterwards, to keep thinking over it and so on and so forth. So the side effects generally are positive. But sometimes that reorientation that I'm talking about, it can bring temporary changes in energy patterns, sleep patterns. Obviously, changes in life direction can come about. Suddenly, your life priorities start to seem a little different than what they were. And the degree to which we can go with that is usually the degree to which there's an ease to our life, there's an unfolding ease. The degree to which we resist it is the degree to which we suffer and we cause stress for ourselves. There can also be changes in things like sleep patterns and things of this kind. If any of those are relevant to any of you, my suggestion is just let them be part of what's happening and don't lose sight of the fact that there's a greater wisdom in charge of all that. There's a greater wisdom at work, and the more that we can put our trust in that, it seems the more able it is to carry us, just to carry us along. It's carrying us anyway, but you know, it's a bit like if you're being carried by someone and you don't really trust them, you don't trust them to not drop you in the river, then what happens is that you tense up and you become, in a way, a more difficult person to be carried. It becomes harder for the person who's carrying you along, because you're fighting and struggling and you're trying to do it yourself. And actually, that's not needed. It's not helpful. It's what's helpful is just to recognize that there's a natural unfolding happening here, and if we can go with it, it's opening out into something very beautiful. I'd like to ask if those of you who are present tonight, if there's anything that either anything that's just on your mind, anything that pops in response to anything I've said, or that was already in the back of your mind, feel free to start sharing and let's see what we have here. So, Didi, thank you. Saying, I noticed very recently I thought I was losing confidence in my abilities as a homeopath. So here's a good example of what we're talking about. I accepted this, and then this morning in Sainsbury's, I bumped into the mother of a child I treated years ago, who recognised me and asked me to treat her husband on Friday. Later on, I bumped into another mother who said a remedy I'd given her daughter a couple of years ago had made a huge difference at the time. And later on again, the patient I'd seen in October briefly walked into the shop at midday and asked if she could have a full consultation because she'd found the first one so helpful. I had to chuckle to myself and say thank you to the universe. So yeah, I mean, it's a nice example of how our own thinking about not only about life but about ourselves and our own abilities and how we're doing and how competent we are or aren't can be so distorted, and it can seem so real at the time. And it's nice sometimes when we're able to just receive feedback of that kind, when we get a friendly nudge that says, "No, you're mistaken. That's not actually true. You know, you're doing a great job, and it's really helpful." And I've had that same experience, Didi, where I've had remind. I've spent whole days sometimes in a workshop setting, and I've come away convinced that no one understood a word what I was trying to say. And that it was a total disaster, and I'd completely wasted my time and their time and everything. And by the time I get home, I've got emails telling me how wonderful it was. I think, huh? How can that be? And again, it's the recognizing the subjective nature of this, and how convincingly we can fool ourselves. It's really quite amazing. What's that? Bernie. Hi, Bernie. Just say there's a delicious feeling to this evening's webinar. That's a nice way of putting it. Thank you. A delicious feeling. Why not? Yeah. What else have we got? Hi, Helen. Can you talk a little bit more about the fact that we don't need to do anything. That's a good one. Well, yes, I can talk a little bit more about that. If there's anything else that you want to say to that, maybe there's a certain kind of doing that you're thinking about in particular, which you can elaborate on if you want. But the first thing that I would say about that is that the starting point is to recognize there's nothing that we can do to, let's say, enhance who we already are. And this is where the whole self-improvement game really is up. It's it's that beautiful Taoist, I think it's a Taoist poem that begins, "The snow goose need not bathe to make itself white." And of course, why doesn't it need to bathe to make itself white? Because it's already white. And the same is true for us. And it's recognizing that all those things that we're doing with the intention of improving ourself or being more of something that we think we're not enough of yet, or developing some quality that we think is missing, it's recognizing that none of those doings can possibly help because we are that already. You know, it's like we're washing to try and make ourselves clean, and we're already whiter than white. We just don't realize it. So This is the part of the three principles understanding, which I probably will overemphasize, but it's for good reason. And it's that part that reminds us of what they call innate health, innate well-being, that it's intact, that who we are in our innermost being is intact and is still buoyant, is still shining through whenever it can in any given moment. And it's only the fact that that shining jewel, if you like, the light becomes obscured, that leads us to think that it's gone out, that it's no longer there, that we have to work to restore it. But it's not the case. It's always there. And Helen, you're adding that it's funny, I can see that the doing doesn't help other people. Well, yes. This is also good to notice, is that when we're in the doing mode, it's a bit like the person I was talking to you about who was tapping on the BlackBerry. She went from the being mode to the doing mode, and I could see quite clearly that the relative value of those two modes was very obvious to me. When she was able to just take a few minutes and just be open and quiet and just to listen to something new and to let it go in, it was touching her, and she was getting it. And then the moment she stopped trusting that, I need to write this down, says the thinking mind, and boom, she was gone. That presence that I could start to see and feel coming through was temporarily lost again. There's the paradox, what her mind was telling her in that moment is that writing this down is going to help you in the future. And what is something that we can only realize for ourselves is that not only does it not help, but it actually takes us away from what we're seeking. And that really is the paradoxical element of it. That's why not only do we not need to do anything, it's the act of doing is the problem that gets in the way. Or feeling that we need to do, let's say, is probably more of an issue. And this is not to imply that a kind of passivity is a desirable or necessary condition. Not at all. It's that everything can still get done despite the fact that we've let go of the need to do it, or we've let go of the drive or the feeling that we have to do it in order to achieve something. So this is the more important thing, I think, is that it's the attachment to the idea that our doing is important and that it's necessary and that it's going to get us somewhere. And when we let go of all that, we can still do what's needed. And often we can do it in a lot shorter time, with a great deal less stress and less effort, and with more benefit for ourselves and the other person. It's like the message gets delivered in a much cleaner, more direct way. If we're in the helping profession, we can still help other people. And in fact, we can be more helped than we ever were. Helen, maybe attempt not to attach to thoughts is my doing, right? Which is exhausting. Yeah, trying not to attach to thoughts can become another doing. It's another thing to try and make happen. It's like, okay, I'm going to make sure I don't get caught in my thinking today. And it's efforting again. And it's easy to know when you get caught in that because you feel it, as you said, Helen, it's exhausting. And it is. So the feedback from the body is consistent and reliable. So if what we're doing is just what arises spontaneously, naturally, it feels good, then it is good. And the chances are it's in the category of the right action. It's what's needed, probably. We're offering something that's actually needed, without adding anything to it, without contaminating it in any way. And if it's not in that, it doesn't have that quality, if it's more something that becomes tiring, it becomes, oh my God, it's exhausting, then there's something contaminating that. It could be a thought of having to, it could be a thought of need, it could be a thought of how important or necessary we think it is, all these things. Hi, Leslie, saying, I've completely changed my relationship to my mother. I go and visit her every day in hospital and find the whole experience joyous, except when it isn't. And generally, all good. That's great. That's lovely. I think this is a great area to not to deliberately test yourself, let's say, but if you find yourself placed in close proximity to your parents or other family members or those individuals who usually seem to have the ability to press our magic buttons. This, of course, is the this is where you get to see, whether that shift that we're talking about is really happening. Because we know that this is one of the positive benefits, is that relationships get easier, they get freer, they become more real, and they become grounded in something more truthful, more joyous, more loving, which again is that's the natural way of relating when we don't put anything else in the way. And it doesn't matter who it's with, It doesn't matter if it's someone that we've had a difficult time with in the past or not. That possibility always exists because that is the default setting for humans, is to relate with love and compassion. Makes me think of that wonderful quote by Ram Dass, you think you're so enlightened and go spend a week with your parents. Which always comes back to me whenever I do go spend a week with my parents. Nina, hi Nina, saying, could you explain your current understanding of psychosomatic disease? It's on my mind for so long, I don't seem to get anywhere with it. From my experience, it seems true, but is it really? Well, it, and I suppose, I mean, first of all, there are different interpretations of what we mean by psychosomatic disease. So if we clarify that, first of all, I'm assuming, Lena, that what you're talking about are health issues that we would say are created directly as a result of psychological and or emotional factors. So that they wouldn't have any life of their own, but for the fact that of some psychological and or emotional influence. Now, is it possible that we can literally think ourselves sick that way? Well, it seems to me, yes, it's definitely possible. And it's also possible that we can have, let's say, we could have a health problem which is also being influenced by other factors. For example, through poisoning or, terrible diet or living in an environment which is inherently unhygienic or unhealthy. That can impact on our health too. So we can't deny these things. The physical body seems to have certain parameters within which it can stay healthy and beyond which it's going to start to suffer. But with that said, even with those kind of complaints, my own sense is that there's almost always a psychosomatic element as well. So there's an additional, usually there's an additional burden of what we're adding to it through our thoughts and feelings. And in that sense, this what we're talking about here is always helpful. It can only be helpful. And we don't need to know ahead of time whether what we're addressing is something which is, let's say, 100% psychosomatic, 80%, or only 20%, Because even to take away the 20% just by relaxing the thinking around it, that can make a big difference to somebody in and of itself. And what I've seen is that the person starts to see how they're adding to their own suffering through thought, and they start to get some sense just of how the mechanism of that works, and they start to settle into that place of being that we're talking about earlier. Well, what they're also doing then is settling into that place of wisdom inside themselves. Or at least they're starting to touch base with that place, let's say more regularly. And what that creates is the possibility that they start to see maybe other things that are that require attention as regards their health. They might start to see that there's something they need to act on, or maybe something they need to stop doing, which is going to have a profound effect. So I think it can cut a number of different ways. You know, first of all, we can certainly look at illnesses like, for example, depression, or I was talking to someone recently about bipolar or manic depression, and these kind of illnesses I would definitely put in the category of psychosomatic, where working on this level can have a profound effect to the extent that that person can go from the place of feeling like they have some kind of organic health problem which cannot be cured, to going from a place of absolute freedom around that. They might still have some ups and downs with their moods, like anybody, but they see them as being ups and downs of moods rather than it being some horrible disease. So I think that's definitely possible. But even with if someone has another kind of health problem, as I say, where there's let's say more physical factors are also part of the deal, there's still a huge value in addressing this side of things and helping that person to come to a place of realization around the contributing factor of thought and feeling. It's got so many positive side effects. Just the fact that if that person is able to start generating more positive feelings, even while they still have the disease, those more positive feelings in turn create a more positive body chemistry. I mean, we know that now through the findings in neuroscience and so on. We're really starting to understand the direct impact on the physiology of different ways of thinking and feeling. So, you know, I think anything that helps us to call off the dogs of the judging mind and the critical mind and the attacking mind and the resisting mind, the resentful mind, you know, all those types of thinking that we can get caught in habitually. If we can just help a person to be a little bit freer around that, it's going to help them whatever the, let's say, the origin of the disease is. And again, if there's anything further on that, Nina, that you want to add, you can bring it in. Leslie, you're adding now. I seem to have a completely different experience to my siblings also. I'm Bernie, confirming something similar. I spent 2 full weeks with my family, Bernie, at Christmas and had a ball. I know. Who'd have thought it? Which is great. Yeah, and Helen, you're mentioning something similar. Just finding you can appreciate your mum for who she is, without needing to hold her to your story of who you thought she was. That's, you know, when we start to see that that's what we've been doing. We've just been holding someone to our own story of who we thought we were, and then we relate to them as if that story was true. And so of course, we experience them in a way that confirms it as being true. And it's remarkable how differently people can show up when we take those glasses off and we start to see them as they are. Yeah. Nina, you've mentioned, I'm so amazed how many of my long-standing physical symptoms have vanished in the last few weeks. Okay, so now I can see where your earlier question was grounded. I still can't believe it. I did nothing with them. I just didn't give them any value and stopped caring what it all meant. Oh, that's great, Nina. That's fantastic. What could be so ridiculously simple? Yeah, that's just amazing. And it's staggering, isn't it? How, you know, it's not a doing. It's not anything that you did. that brought that change about. It's a stopping doing, and it's a letting go of, giving them as some kind of importance, some kind of extra value. That's like the feeding process that that happens, when we latch on to certain thoughts as being true and real, and we just lay down a banquet for them, and we keep feeding them and feeding them and feeding them, and so consequently they stick around and they seem more and more real with each passing day. And the moment we stop doing that, it's as if someone is, it's like someone just pops the balloon. All the energy, all the air just starts to get sucked out of it. And realizing that it was only us that was feeding it. It's an amazing thing. So that's great, you know. It's a great, wonderful example of how, you don't even need to know, or was it psychosomatic? How much? To what degree? We don't know, And it probably doesn't matter, These things we can't really exactly ever know, I don't think. But we could, draw a tentative conclusion that there must have been some contribution on the psychological level, which, as soon as you stop making that contribution, then the body starts to show up differently. Yeah, that's great. I think the work of people like Bruce Lipton is interesting in this regard. The guy is the author of the Biology of Belief. I think he has another book out recently. He's a scientist working in cellular biology, the realm of DNA, and challenging the whole notion of programming via the genes has been something which is kind of predetermined, something, this idea, which is, even though there's a lot of evidence against it, it's still widely promoted in the, certainly in the media and the popular press, that there's a gene for this disease, there's a gene for this sexual orientation, there's a disease for this psychological condition, as if, finding that the person has that gene means that this is an inevitable outcome. The genie in my genes. Yes, thank you, Didi. And his research, and other people's as well, has started to show quite conclusively that this is really not the case, that consciousness is the overriding, most powerful factor in all of this. And that, what this is the power source behind what determines whether those genes get activated or they don't, and to what degree, is what kind of beliefs that we hold, which is, again, it's just a kind of thinking that's habitually repeated over a period of time. That when that programming gets laid down, then it has a certain consequence in the body. But it can just as easily be reprogrammed, It's and just recognize it. It's not a big deal. The body can respond remarkably quickly to these shifts in consciousness. It's great. It's a very, very David Bowie, the gene genie. Yeah. And for me, what I like is to, I like the fact that this, let's say, understanding or shift in perception that we're talking about can have such wide-reaching ramifications. It can touch so many areas, and any one of us is free to specialize if we know, if we want to. We can take this, as many people have done. We can take it into a particular field. Some people have, just taken it specifically into the area of addiction, say, and some people have taken it into sports psychology. Some people have worked, in with depression and, clinical psychological cases and so on. And to me, this is a wonderful thing. If we've got a particular interest in a certain area, it's a, you know, it's like a multi-tool device that we can take anywhere and start to just explore without knowing really what the possibilities are. And the great thing about not knowing is that they're probably much bigger than the ones we can imagine. That's what I like about it. It's still a relatively new field. It's a wide open field. There must be huge areas that have not been even, you know, haven't even scratched the surface of what are the possibilities for transforming physical health, for example, with shifts of this kind. It must be way, way bigger than we think. You know, we know about the placebo effect. We know about cases of spontaneous remission, and so forth. And you know, these sudden miraculous healing phenomena have always happened in, you know, every field, even within the orthodox field. They've happened. They've just been called spontaneous remission, and there's no explanation for them. But there's never been a kind of science behind that, in a way. And only now are we starting to see that, you know, how we apply our consciousness and our thinking might just be one of the big clues to understanding this. I think Brandon Bay's work, Deepak Chopra's work, you know, people working on this interface of consciousness and the physical body, it's like pioneer work still. We're just starting to open up this whole area. What's that, Leslie? What do we take? Do you mean what remedy? Well, of course, that's the homeopath's question for everything, isn't it? Well, that's all well and good, but what should we be taking? I don't know anymore. I don't know. As Dee Dee adding, until recently, humans thought the world was flat. Well, that's true too. Yeah, I mean, there's so many examples of where we've collectively assumed that things were a certain way, and as long as we thought that way, it was true in our experience, and that it only took one or a small number of individuals to think different, you know, to have a new thought, to see a new possibility, and then suddenly that new perspective becomes available to the rest of us. That's what's happening now with this, and it's amazing how, for me, it's amazing how quickly this could become available to huge numbers of people because of its simplicity. This is not something that can be regulated against or, you know, made too complex so that the message gets lost. It's like, I'm sure that, you know, even though despite our best efforts to do so, we won't succeed at complicating this because there's nothing to it, you know. It's still so simple. Yeah, fun, laughter, and joy, Didi. I mean, that's it, isn't it? Those are the things, and no one can patent it. That's it. Nobody can own it as such. It's something that we can, you know, we can explore it, we can share it, we can find our own way of relating to it and making sense of it, and then deepening in that over time through our own experience. And then finding a way to express that which is uniquely ours, which is already happening. And I can see that for many of you, that you're starting to see possibilities of how this can and will infiltrate different areas of your life, including your work life. It's exciting. And tis my pleasure to be sharing it with you guys. I'm really, really enjoying the fact that that we have this opportunity, and that as a group that you're willing to show up and to you know, to stick around it for a duration of time, trusting that something's gonna click into place. Maybe not all at once, but maybe a little bit at a time. That gradually something's going to open up. So thank you all of you. I without you, what I'm doing here would not be possible either. So I do appreciate that. All right. Well, I'm aware of the fact that time is flying and has flown. So unless there's anything that any of you feel moved to add, I'm going to wind it up at this point. A couple of you asked if it was possible to record this and have it available as a download so you could listen to it subsequently, which reminds me a bit of the person with the BlackBerry, making sure she got it down so she wouldn't forget. So maybe you're not bothered about downloads anymore after I said that, but if you are, I've attempted to record this separately tonight, and as you know, I've had a few gremlins in the technology so far, but I'm just plodding on regardless, doing the best with what I have. So assuming that it came out as a recording independently of the system here, I'll upload it and send you a link where you can listen and or download. And if that's what you want to do, that's fine with me. So thank you all, one and all. Thank you, everybody. It's lovely to spend the time checking in with you once again. We're going to be meeting up in London quite soon, just a few more weekends away, first weekend in February, and really looking forward to seeing you there. And in the meantime, oh, hi Debbie, you did make it. I'm glad. And yeah, in the meantime, don't worry about remembering anything. Don't worry about working on anything, doing anything. You know, it is already percolating through. It's you know, it's reaching the parts that it needs to reach. Just keep trusting that. And the more that we all trust that, the more it'll happen by itself. I'm quite sure of that. So thank you once again, and I'm gonna end the recording here. And good night, everybody, and sweet dreams.